From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Marriage and the Family in History. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars of European culture, Michael Screech of Oxford University and Lawrence Stone of Princeton University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Michael Screech about marriage and the family in European history as seen through the work of two Frenchmen, the comic poet Rabelais and the essayist Michel de Montaigne. Here is Michael Screech.
Well, I think this two quick answers, really, one to prepare the other. Rabelais was a priest. He was an outstanding lawyer, expert in the history of law. He was an absolutely outstanding doctor and a first-rate theologian. His learning was the wonder of the age, and people knew that. Mm-hmm. Now, this learning he applies to comic purposes. His job is to make us laugh. He makes us laugh by making us reject certain ideas and accept others. Mm-hmm. Now, what is for us interesting is his doing that, but also his presuppositions, which made him laugh a particular way. And I think for us, we can sit back and read Rabelais and enjoy him. We can accept all his prejudices and all those ideas which he thought to be true. And insofar as we enjoy reading his books, we shall do that. But we shall be aware that in certain areas, we certainly have made advances in Rabelais' day, and that some of Rabelais' ideas were wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I'm still a little at sea here. I need some specifics to hang all of this on.
I think it's important. What is marriage for? There's always been marriage. Christianity hasn't invented marriage. Mm-hmm. As it were, Mrs. Moses was married and Mrs. Cicero was married. Christians introduced to St. Paul the notion that marriage was there to avoid fornication. Not that it was only there for that, but a man should marry to avoid fornication. Mm-hmm. If he hasn't got the gift of celibacy, he should marry. This meant that in a Christian context, there's always a tendency to put the emphasis upon the ability of the man or the woman to refrain from sexual intercourse. And if they cannot do so, they must marry. And once married, they must give each other the sexual intercourse they need.
Oh, now this is a pretty dim view of human nature, is it not? Or human behavior?
Oh, yes. Rabelais has a very dim view of human nature. Uh-huh. He believes strongly in original sin. That's why he finds human beings so funny, when they think they do not suffer from original sin. For him, it's sexuality. And throughout his books, the marriage is seen in terms of, one, a remedy to fornication, and secondly, the Genesis view of man with his helpmeet, his wife, who together can found a family and bring up children.
All right, now those are, forgive me if I'm treading on the toes of Rabelais, but those sound like entirely modern notions. What transition might have occurred between his thinking and ours?
Very real one, I think. He would not have in any way doubted the subordination of the woman to the man in a proper Christian wedlock. Hmm. He didn't mean the husband bossed the wife around, but the man is the head of the woman, as Christ is the head of the church. As such, the man might have to be crucified for his wife. It's worth remembering that.
All right, and he what? He turns this to comic purposes?
Turns it to comic purposes by showing how a man can be so overcome by his sexuality that he doesn't think straight, uh-huh. or how he could be subordinated to the whims of his wife, how he can fail to do his duty to himself and to his state and to his job by constantly dancing attendance upon a demanding wife. But where he will for us be forever, as it were, in the wrong, uh-huh. is that we tend to forget that nobody in the 16th century, not even Rabelais, one of the top doctors the world has ever known, had any idea of how children were born. Uh-huh. Of course he knew how they were born in the womb and how they were delivered, but the view of all doctors and of all other disciplines, that's that nobody taught anything else, was that the man planted a seed, the semen, and that the woman contributed nothing to that process. Or, if they followed Galen, the ancient doctor, she contributed a weaker secondary semen. Mm-hmm. So that whenever a child was born, he was the result, or she was the result, of a seed planted by the mother.
So what we're doing here is resorting, what, to Renaissance medicine for a notion of Renaissance marriage?
Yes, you can't do anything else.
Uh-huh.
The medical views are always terribly important on the conception of marriage. The medical view on AIDS will make a great difference to the conception of marriage in the United States for
Indeed
the next 15 years.
What about law? You mentioned
law.
Is that not important in the Renaissance notion
Vital.
Of marriage?
Rabelais thinks that a man has got to find a way to marry if he cannot control his production of semen. The woman will also have analogous problems because her body wishes to receive the semen. Marriage is one of the ways in which this can be properly canalized in Christian doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But Christian doctrine and Roman law clash on the question of who has the authority to decide who should marry whom.
Are we talking about possession? Are we talking about property? That kind
no,
of thing?
No, I know this is part of the sort of jargon almost of certain feminist movements nowadays. I think it's a coarse view of the past and frankly based upon American notions of property.
Uh-huh.
I think it's in the 16th century it'd be quite different. In the Roman law, which still had great powers of persuasion in the 16th century, put all children under the authority of the pater familias, that is normally the father, but sometimes the grandfather. Sons could, at some age, be freed of that. Daughters, never. Where they would pass from a father to a brother to an uncle or someone with authority to protect them because they were considered as weaker in relationship to the law. A marriage was essentially a contract established by the parents of the children concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It produced very often, of course, very happy marriages, as, for example, arranged marriages still do in India and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But they were not based upon a concept of love, of romantic love, such as we know, shall we say, from films,
mm-hmm.
where two people see each other, fall in love, and live happily ever afterwards, as we see all our fellow men and women doing.
Let's turn the conversation to Montaigne, the French essayist, who comes a little later.
Yes.
He doesn't quite... does he overlap here with
Montaigne was born when Rabelais published his first important book.
Mm-hmm. He lives almost to the end of the 16th
almost
century.
Almost to the end of the 16th century. He's the second half of the 16th century man. Rabelais is the first half.
All right. What can we learn here from this Renaissance figure?
Well, here we've got an entirely
about
different
love and marriage.
Here we've got a man who was married, presents himself very strongly as a Roman Catholic, though that has been misunderstood both before and since our present day, who had a daughter. Most of his children died young. He learned to bear that. He wrote a great deal in his book, which is the most original book certainly to have ever been written up to the time that he wrote. It was an exploration of himself, an attempt to find out what a human being, i.e. himself, is, and how he fitted in with other human beings. It was an extraordinary book.
Early autobiography.
Or more than biography. He wanted to find out. You see, people didn't know what a man was. If you think of Shakespeare, where people can travel around the world and find human beings whose heads are between their shoulders, where Caliban is not human, Montaigne was convinced that even the natives discovered in the New World, even the American Indians...
there was a question of their humanity.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Montaigne's completely convinced they're human. Humanity everywhere he sees.
Uh-huh.
And being human, he would see as part of himself. He was human too. His discovery, partly through his reflections on his own sexuality, was that actually women were human too. I don't mean that as a joke. He saw them fully human.
Was that a new idea for his time?
Up to a point. You see, Roman law saw woman as weak in the technical word. She had fragilitas. She was weak and therefore didn't have the full ability to make decisions which the man could make. Medicine saw woman as so subordinated to her sexuality that in the words that Rabelais uses, it's possible that nature was not thinking of the perfection of the individual woman, but thinking more of the perpetuation of the species.
Goodness.
Well, the only change which perhaps the 19th century made would have put the man in the same category as the woman, rather than raising the woman to the category of the man.
And adding some sentimentality and a strong dose of feeling to the mix.
Yes. Rabelais' characters, as so many people in the Renaissance, love their wives, and their wives love their husbands, remember.
Yeah.
But it's based on different assumptions about what the role of our sexuality is, how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Montaigne was, like as many men of his period, not particularly straight-laced. his father was. He tells us with great surprise and great admiration that his father, whom he deeply loved, came virgin to his marriage bed, although he'd fought in the Italian wars and was not a young man. He was very impressed with that, because Montaigne most certainly did not. On the other hand, Montaigne was surprised that he'd kept his marriage vows much better than he thought he ever would have been able to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Montaigne thinks that there are three major forms of human intercourse. They're in reverse order, in a way. He believes that a man can have intercourse in his sense. That means, of course, commerce with other people through books.
Mm-hmm.
As an old man, it's perhaps the only thing open to him. He likes to read honest books, he calls them, good books. You can also have it with honest women and honest friends. The word honest is, of course, you need a book to explain, but it means basically honest and decent. He would have thought that normal friendship, not the very profound friendship which he will also write about, normal friendship between men is largely a question of intellect. The friendship which you could have with women would have a much heavier dose of the physical.
Mm-hmm.
And he would think that whilst women in general would not have the same intellectual edge that the man would have, she would make up for it by her charm. Not necessarily a superficial charm, you're not just being pretty,
mm-hmm.
but a woman would be present as a physical person far more than a friend would be.
Femininity.
Femininity. And this, of course, well, of course, this is also part of the philosophical tradition of the West, which tended to put relations with women in a very corporeal, physical category.
Uh-huh.
Montaigne never puts it only in a physical category, but he would say that a particular woman may be less intelligent than a particular man, but she may be more fun to be with. I don't mean sexually,
yeah.
because her femininity will be there as something contributing fun and enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
He does ask himself on one occasion whether it would be possible to link together the two aspects, that is what we would now call friendship and what we would call love for a woman. And he thinks it would be possible, but he does point out that no ancient example has ever shown it to have been possible, and they were very influenced by what the Greeks and the Romans had done and thought.
These were the models.
No ancient philosopher had ever suggested that a woman could be the friend of a man in the same way as a man could be.
Right.
But he does say if it were possible to arrange that, it would be the height of desirable relationships.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly sought friendship with women, or sought relationships with women which were not entirely sexual, but they were never entirely unsexual either. He was always aware that a woman was a woman.
Mm-hmm. In other words, he recognized the complexity of the situation.
Well, if ever any man did, he did, yes.
Michael Screech, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about Renaissance conceptions of marriage and friendship and sexuality, with particular reference to Rabelais and Montaigne. What might be the harshest thing that either or both of these writers would say about our notions of marriage in the 1980s?
When they write of marriage, they are when they're writing of sexual relationships, they are thinking primarily of marriage. And marriage was seen as a God-given means of perpetuating the name and arms, as Rabelais puts it, of the father. I think what they would have seen lacking in modern marriage was the respect for the father and the respect for the father's rights.
Mm-hmm.
It is noticeable that the warmest relationships of all in Rabelais' chronicles are the relationships between father and son.
Hmm.
It is also striking that in the essays, the warmest tribute that Montaigne pays to anyone is first of all to his friend and secondly to his father. And I think that both of them would have took a look at modern marriage, at least not my own, but of many around, and say the father has been devalued in it. Secondly, they would have noticed the impermanence of it, because that would have been deeply shocking. Not that they thought the marriages were happy, but necessarily happy, but mm-hmm. they did think they were for life. They were separated by death only.
Michael Screech teaches at Oxford University. He participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center on marriage and the family in Renaissance European culture. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Marriage and the Family in History continues now with a discussion featuring another recent visitor at the center. Lawrence Stone is a professor at Princeton University. He's at work on a 3-volume study of marriage and the family in 17th and 18th century British culture. Lawrence Stone, you come to the Humanities Center from Princeton University. You're a social historian. Tell me about the family in the 18th century. Is it appreciably different compared to what we see as we look about us today?
Yes, there was in the process of rapid change in the 18th century, and I think the modern family of today takes its origins from the 18th century, which is why I'm interested in it.
Uh-huh.
A period in which marriage for economic interests began to take lesser significance than marriage for love or for romanticism or for sexual fulfillment, of things of this sort.
Mm-hmm.
And this dialogue between interest, as they called it, money, power, etc., and personal affection was being fought out right through the 18th century, and that comes out in English novels right through the period, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Tell me about divorce, for example. How did that work in the 18th century? Statistically, how do we compare in the 1980s? I say we, maybe we should say Great Britain now and then.
The contrast is total, because there was no divorce, mm-hmm. literally no divorce at all in England in the 18th century.
What happened when people got unhappy with one another?
A variety of things could happen. One of them, you could just walk out and slam the door. That was amongst the poor. That was the commonest and easiest way of doing it. Another one for a battered wife, for example, was to take the husband to court and ask for separation from bed and board. That didn't give you the right to remarry, but it did give you a right to separation with alimony and enough to live on.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, either party could sue the other again for separation for adultery. This was the one cause which was theoretically on both parts. In fact, of course, this was a double standard society, and if the male adultery on the whole was treated as fairly casual,
mm-hmm.
and the female adultery was very serious. So there was a very complicated dual arrangement going on. There's also complications. The husband was responsible for the maintenance of his wife, so long as she was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, she was also had a claim on him for what's called dower, that is to say, enough money to live on after his death, if the wife outlived the husband, as she usually did. So the two were interlocked, and economically it was very difficult to disentangle under this method. So what would happen occasionally, not often, in the working class, was they'd stage a thing called a wife sale. That is to say, in
a wife sale.
A wife sale.
Goodness.
And what would happen was that the marriage would de facto be broken up.
Uh-huh.
The woman had found a lover with whom she wanted to live thereafter. He wanted to get rid of her for his own purposes, too. They were quite agreed about that. An agreement would be made in advance between the lover, the husband, and the wife that the lover would buy her for, say, 5 shillings or something. Or 1 pound.
Oh, goodness.
The man would then put a halter around the neck of the wife, take her into the cattle market on a market day, put her on the block, and say, I offer this woman for sale.
Mm-hmm.
The lover would then say, I bid 1 shilling for her. Done. And that was it. And the three would usually then adjourn to a tavern for a drink, and that would be the end of it, and the lover would go off. Now, the reason for this rather bizarre procedure was to try and make maximum publicity that each was legally free from the other in terms of contractual agreements of any sort or kind.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to use the contract procedure of selling a cow or heifer or bull or something, to selling a wife.
This wouldn't necessarily have originated in the idea of a direct insult to a woman. What was happening here was a replication of another social pattern.
Yeah, precisely. They were using the social pattern of selling cattle mm-hmm. to try and get themselves free from the financial disentanglement with one another.
Mm-hmm.
The courts, however, of course, were furious. Whenever this turned up in a law court, the Chief Justice and the Lord Chancellor were saying, this is an outrageous procedure, it's disgusting, it's humiliating, and we pay no attention to this. Legally,
indeed,
it's worthless.
Uh-huh.
It didn't happen very often. Whenever it did happen, huge crowds collected, obviously, to see the fun, and it was reported in the newspapers. So I think we're fairly sure this was fairly rare.
Mm-hmm. If you could isolate a single distinguishing factor by which you would differentiate our conceptions of marriage, either in America or Great Britain in the 1980s, set against notions of marriage, marriageability in 18th century England, is there such a way, or am I tempting you to oversimplify unnecessarily there?
Well, you are, of course, but naturally. I think we can say there's two ways. One is that it is alleged nowadays, true or false, it is alleged that most people marry, or they claim to be marrying, either for love, meaning a romantic sentiment, mm-hmm. or for sexual attraction, lust, if you like. One of these two. Now, in the 18th century, both those were regarded as very, very poor reasons to get married. Both of them were regarded as ephemeral. They won't last. Romantic love won't last. Sexual attraction won't last. Therefore, you must have something much more fundamental, which could either be money or affection, deep, settled, lasting affection. So mm-hmm. those things, that's one thing. The second thing is that marriage, as I say, in the 18th century was for good, for life. It was permanent. You couldn't break it, almost impossible to break it. Today, it is an ephemeral contract, and you get fed up with it. You just get divorced and start uh-huh. again.
Is marriage weaker or stronger, in your opinion? You have looked at it over a period of a couple of hundred years. I'll ask you to be personal for a moment. What conclusion do you draw, having looked at all of that information?
Well, I think that the more you raise the expectations from marriage, the more you demand in terms of sexual fulfillment and love and so on from a marriage, the more likely it is to people be disappointed, the more likely it is they're going to break up.
Mm-hmm.
The marriages which most rapidly broke up, in my view, in the 18th century were those which were either totally dictated by the parents, totally for economic grounds, they would tend to break up, or romantic runaway love marriages by very young people under the age of 20, 21, mm-hmm. who just fell in love and wanted to go to bed together and just rushed off and got married. Mm-hmm. They're the two groups which fell apart most frequently.
Mm-hmm. Was there such a thing, for example, Lawrence Stone, as marriage counseling? Marriage, I take it, was an institution. Were there people beyond what? The clergy. Were there interested parties who would help young people along, try to educate them? You mentioned the peril of expectations outrunning reality. How did that work?
Well, there was the parson, as you rightly say, the clergyman, who was always nearly always influential. There's the parents, mm-hmm. There's the kin, the very widespread kin who would be giving advice, and then there's the neighbors. Hmm. It's a very neighborly society, and neighbors felt themselves responsible, and if a marriage started breaking up or wife beating began, the neighbors would interfere and make comments and criticize and give advice. Women particularly, I think there's a lot of women's solidarity in the street, right down the street. And pressuring the wife to behave better or pressuring the husband to behave better.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was very important. Mm-hmm. So my view is that neighbors were extremely important in a way that today we're locked away in our separate detached houses with 100 yards or so or 10 yards between one another, and we're all on our own.
Yeah. Be specific for me, Lawrence Stone. Tell me a story from 18th century English history about the relationship between power and love, power and money. You can fill in the blanks as you choose.
Well, let's take a typical situation of an upper-class parent, there are many, many cases of this, in the 18th century, who make an arranged marriage for a child. They will get together with the parents of the potential spouse. They will settle the financial agreement arrangements in order to unite perhaps two huge estates and large incomes and great houses and so on. The lawyers will draw up the bonds and contracts, etc. And then the prospective wife and the prospective husband will be introduced to one another and asked to accept this. Now, what frequently happened was, not frequently, but occasionally happened, was that the two would kick over the traces and refuse to go along with this. What would they do? They would go off and have what was called a clandestine marriage. That is to say, you ran away secretly and you bribed a parson to marry you secretly. Before 1753, when a new law was passed, you could just go down into some areas of London where the place was crawling with impoverished, drunken parsons who, for 5 shillings, would marry you in an alehouse or a brothel or something. But that would be legally, despite the squalor of the surroundings, that would be legally binding, that was it. Good. And their parents were stuck.
Mm-hmm.
After 1753, that wasn't possible. So what you then did was you took a coach and you went hell for leather for Scotland. And the moment you got across the border in Scotland, a place called Gretna Green, just where the main road crossed the border,
mm-hmm.
there were some parsons hanging around waiting, and they would marry you within 5 minutes.
Las Vegas.
Exactly.
That's what you're telling.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And this was almost impossible for the parents to break, and they were stymied. So these were the dramatic contrasts between parental control and marriage for money and marriage for love, mm-hmm. At the wishes of the spouses.
Tell me about power within the marriages themselves. Have we changed that much? Are we talking what? About history, or are we talking about human nature and trying to figure out the difference between the two?
Well, we're talking about both. Mm-hmm. And obviously, human nature is, in some ways, the controlling factor. In any marriage, the spouse with the strongest personality is going to win and call the shots. This is a fact of life. And if the woman happens to be the most powerful personality, she is going to, at any period of time, be the dominant personality. But the legal constraints of the 18th century were all in favor of the man. The man controlled the money. The woman did not have a legal personality. Her property became the property of her husband at marriage. The husband was entitled to beat her if he thought she was getting out of line, within mm-hmm. reason, of course, and so on.
Lawrence Stone, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about marriage in the 18th century through the 20th century. What do we learn from it? Is it possible? Do you stick your neck out and say that that history has lessons for us, for example, with regard to something like marriage and the family?
I think we can learn warnings of what to do and what not to do. My own opinion is that the level of divorce at the moment, for example, is reaching a point where it is counterproductive. The more unhappy people wandering around than happy people. If a divorce is designed to create happiness, it's rather dubious whether a divorce at this level is actually doing that. One of the problems was stated by David Hume in the 18th century when he was arguing against divorce, and he says, if you allow divorce, then at the back of everybody's mind whenever they have a row with their spouse is, to hell with this, I'm going to walk out and get divorced and start again. Mm-hmm. Whereas there is no such loophole, people say, oh, well, I'll have to live with her for better or for worse, and they tend to get along. And that is not a rather basic observation of David Hume, which I think is, in fact, true. The other observation Hume made at the time was the other problem is the problem of the children. How far are you disrupting the children's lives? I should point out, in the 18th century, what makes it very different from today is that the wife was totally deprived of all contact and all control over her children after a separation. Total. Once she was separated, the husband had total control of the children. He usually forbade any contact by her forever.
Was that on the basis of the fact that, to put it a little harshly, the children were property?
Yes.
As simple as that?
The children were his legal property to do as he liked with, and he could dictate who they should see and who they should not see, uh-huh. and he almost invariably dictated they should not see the mother.
Uh-huh. Quick footnote to our conversation, Lawrence Stone. If you used a single adjective to describe marriage in the 18th century, what would it be? Legal? Moral? Political? How best do we get a handle on it?
I don't think we can get a handle on it at all with the one sentence. What I've been trying to say is we're in a transitional stage in which is a very, very ambiguous and conflictual situation in which you're moving from one situation to another and no single word will sum it up.
Lawrence Stone is a professor at Princeton University. Lawrence Stone is at work on a 3-volume history of marriage and the family in British culture. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Marriage and the Family in European History, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be religion and government in American society. My guest will be John Somonchi of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about marriage and the family in European history and culture. Wayne's guests are Michael Screech of Oxford University and Lawrence Stone of Princeton University. The Evolution of Modern Marriage and Manners, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.